The Guardian.
Hello, it's Natalie Nahai, and before we get started with this week's show, I'd like to point you in the direction of Squarespace, the easiest way to create a beautiful, responsive website that'll look great on all devices, from computers and tablets to smartphones. For your free 14-day trial, visit squarespace.com. On today's show, a subject that is always topical and yet only occasionally makes the news. A problem that threatens everything we value, and including our lives, and yet isn't discussed around the dinner table. Climate change. We might know that it's happening, but we don't always know what we can do to help. Today we'll be asking the questions, could new technology hold the answer for climate change? And how can tech be used on small, localized levels to create massive change with global implications? We'll be tackling these topics with three keynote speakers from Manchester's Future Everything Festival, a conference that showcases innovations in digital culture and technology. This year, the most debated theme is resource management and climate change. In an episode where the worlds of technology and science collide, this is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. At the intersection of research and design lies Project UCO, a project created for EUPORIAS, the European Provision of Regional Impact Assessments on Seasonal and Decadal Timescales. From a video clip on Project UCO's website, here's Moritz Steffener, the project data visualization specialist, explaining the project rather technically.
It's a world map with a data overlay. The thickness of the lines indicates the predicted wind speeds in a region. The predictive scale of our model is shown in the opacity of these symbols. Bright, very visible lines mean our model has been very useful in this region in the past, but we don't show any symbols if no useful prediction can be made. Finally, the most...
That will all make a whole lot more sense in just a couple of minutes. With us in the studio today, we have Drew Hammond, Project Director for UCO and Founder and Creative Director of Future Everything Festival. Hey Drew, it's great to have you.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So you've just heard a superbly complicated explanation of Project UCO. Put as simply as possible in your words, what is Project UCO?
Project UCO is a tool that visualizes future wind conditions. So climate science is producing an incredible new capacity to predict further into the future. So rather than the weather for the coming days, we're talking about months, the next seasons, even decades. And that has huge implications, not just for those of us who want to know if there'll be snow or sunshine on our next holiday, but for agriculture, for managing flood risk, all sorts of areas. It's hugely significant. And Project UCO makes that information, which often comes in very, very complex form, accessible so that non-scientists can browse that information and use it in decision making.
So how did the project begin and why was it started?
The origin of Project UCO goes back a long way. In about 2006, we really woke up to climate change and we thought, well, what can we do as designers, as technologists? And we went through a whole set of things from, a carbon audit of our festival, setting up a new globally networked event to avoid, air travel, all this stuff. And through this, we did some really nice collaborations with some climate scientists. These led to some art projects in our festival, where we experimented in novel ways to capture climate data. And one of them, one of my favorites, was a project called Climate Bubbles. And we worked with a senior scientist at the Met Office called Carlo Buontempo. And we set ourselves a challenge to capture a new data set that the Met Office couldn't capture any other way, that would enable us to monitor the urban heat island phenomenon, the phenomenon that cities are hotter than the surrounding countryside. And an indicator of that is wind, wind speed and direction. And we developed this project where we had these bubble blowing games, the bubble chase and the bubble race. So you'd blow a bubble, chase after it until it pops or lands, blow another one, repeat that 10 times, upload the start and end point to get wind direction, and then you'd race bubbles and time them to
Amazing.
Get wind speed. Yeah, I know. And so we did this as part of the festival with thousands of people across the city doing it to create this data set. And something really funny happened along the way. Well, first off, all the best ideas were coming from Carlo, and he's supposed to be the scientist, but I realized he was actually working as an artist. So I asked him, can we list you as an artist on this project? And he was like, I'd better go and check back in the office. So he spoke back to the office and yeah, you can. And then during the project, it was all weather dependent. So I was getting, you know, updates from the senior forecasters at the Met Office and interpreting these and publishing little updates on the weather. So I said to Carlo, does this make me a weather forecaster? So he ended up being listed as an artist and I was listed as a weather forecaster on this project. And we stayed in touch. And Carlo, since then, has headed up the Climate Impacts Department at the Met Office. And he invited me into Euporias, which is this really major project to try and support the emergence of climate services, they're called, which is about bespoke information for particular users, particular industries, and crucially over seasonal to decadal timescales, which, as I say, is really, you know, state of the art in climate forecasting. And he brought me in really just with a very open brief to see what art and design could contribute. And both of us were thinking initially that it might be something much more about, you know, how art could maybe, you know, bring new perspectives or you know, challenge the science or, you know, support people to live with uncertainty, you know. But we focused on something that was actually very design based because we identified a particular roadblock, a real challenge that was you know, really inhibiting the development of these services, and that was just the complexity of this information.
Because surely people have tried to interpret long term wind patterns before, so I'm curious to know how the technology for Project UCO developed and how it's different from what already exists.
In Project UCO, we're collaborating with scientists at the Barcelona Supercomputing Centre who've developed a prototype called Resilience. And this is really drawing on the state-of-the-art climate forecasts and is producing forecasts over the coming months for wind around the globe. And what we've done is we've come in and worked as designers. We've brought in Moritz Steffener, who's you know, an incredible data visualization artist, to look at this information and look at the needs of users, you know, people in the wind energy sector who might be, you know, managing wind farms or what have you, find out what they need to know to make decisions, which often is, you know, when are there going to be, you know, severe changes in wind over the coming months. And we've created an interface to present that information, present the information that they need in an accessible format. So the interface is, it gives a global view to start with. It's very easy to get an overview, to browse in, to see features of interest. And then you can drill down and then you can look at the complex information that underpins each individual value.
Sounds fantastic. So Project UCO presents detailed wind data in a way that's very easy for people to access and understand. How do you think this might impact the environment in the future?
Project UCO is an example of a climate service that can make society more resilient to climate change and climate variability. It's not about preventing climate change, which of course is absolutely urgent, but it's about being able to respond to extreme weather events, which are how we experience climate change in the here and now. And it's equipping both the public, or in this case energy, such as wind energy sector, with the means to manage these changes, to equip themselves and prepare themselves for the future.
Now, most people tend to be frustrated with environmental issues precisely because it's very difficult to create substantial change on an individual level and to get access to this kind of information that you're talking about. But your small team has achieved something really extraordinary in spite of that kind of belief. What would your advice be to any of our listeners who might want to create positive change in the environment? Is there anything that you think they could be doing?
I can only really share our experience. You know, we woke up to climate change in, you know, 2005, 2006, and we set out to see how we could draw on design and art to make a small difference. We tried many things. We did a carbon audit of our festival. We discovered the carbon footprint's all about air travel. So for a couple of years, we experimented in globally networked events with venues around the world and using telepresence so people didn't have to travel. We did sort of art experiments capturing data on the climate in new ways. We tried many experiments, and that provided the background to Project UCO, where as a team of designers, we've collaborated in what's a really big project to create something that hopefully can signpost a new way of working with climate data and can actually make an impact in industries and to society's resilience to climate change.
So what's something that I could go home and do today?
Cycle.
Great. Cycle, get on that bike. After the break, we'll be talking to a woman who is working to improve the way that we interpret information and solve big problems. We'll be right back.
If you've got a mobile business, you need an easy way to take multiple payment types with one integration. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more. Braintree also has quick, knowledgeable developer support, so there's help whenever you need it. The Braintree V.0 SDK, one snippet of code and you're all set up and ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. To find out more and for your first £30,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly.
We've heard about an up-and-running project that uses existing data to positively impact the environment. But what about the data itself? Interpreting the information that exists around us is surely a vital step in the process of developing new technologies that can benefit the planet. Joining us in the studio now, we have Lydia Nicholas, a writer and senior researcher at NASDAQ, who has a Master's of Science in Digital Anthropology, which is fascinating. She examines how people interpret, understand, and use information, and tries to find ways for them to work with information better. Lydia, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So in any given project, do you feel that gathering information and research is one of the most important steps in the process?
Well, yeah, I'd agree that it's one of the most important things. And one of the things that I'm very lucky about in NESTA is that we tend to approach things in a very open way. So we will ask questions, genuinely not knowing what the answer is, which anyone who's worked in research and in academia knows can be quite hard to negotiate. But on the other hand, the way that that information is communicated to people is vitally important in it having any kind of impact, any kind of use in the real world. So one of the things that I've looked at in the past is the different ways that people will attribute value or validity to different kinds of information that's presented to them in different ways, or the way that information that comes from particular sources can be credited as having more power or certainty than information that comes from someone else. There's one of the things that we've looked at very much in a current project in the ethics and regulation of the use of machine learning in government is that as people, we will, broadly speaking, attribute numerical data and outputs from machines as having more certainty or more validity than a human opinion. Whereas in fact, of course, every number carries a million stories, a million decisions in what to capture, what to clean up and present in the final auditing process, or what to consider as noise. And this is true throughout the sciences and also throughout the kind of work that gets presented to someone trying to make a decision in government. So processes of making information clear and usable in the ways that Project UCO does and that data visualization work does is hugely important. And one of the things that NESTA tries to do is be a conduit between academic research and the kind of practical applications that people might want to do. If they're a local council that's trying to use new technologies in a radical way to empower people to get involved in direct democracy or in community energy or in health projects.
Fantastic. So you described a little bit there about what NESTA does. What are some of the ways in which they reach out to communities that might otherwise not understand the data or the research or the science? Because there does seem to be this kind of this sense of what Rory Sutherland has called scientism, the idea that we'll take data, like you say, from machines or from the science and academic practices and attribute greater meaning and value to that whilst not understanding the mechanics or the process behind it. So how does NESTA help inform and educate people and engage them?
Yeah, so we have a number of projects that encourage people to get involved directly with information and contribute to decision-making processes and things that have direct impacts on their lives. We have the Decent project, which develops tools for direct democracy and economic empowerment. And we have, say, the 100 for Parkinson's project with U-Motif, which involves both people with Parkinson's collecting data across a number of different axes and seeing how different kinds of treatments and exercise regimes affects that, but also collects data from the general public in order to provide comparisons, because that's, we don't necessarily actually always have the information on a healthy, a quote-unquote healthy population.
Mm-hmm. So that's actually going back to Drew's point about intelligence as a resource. That's something that Nesta does and aims to do quite well, actually.
So we had a series of events over the last couple of years on exploring how collective intelligence develops, how it emerges as a resource, and how it can best be managed, and the current tools that are available for doing that. And naturally, that has led into more work on artificial intelligence, because as soon as you start using a decision support tool and something that enables you to connect with people in complicated ways, the intelligence that's in the technology begins to take on more and more assumptions to guide your interactions in ways that need to be inspected and held up. So we do look at how people can contribute, but also how we can manage those contributions ethically.
So when we're talking about things like ethics and getting people to contribute and managing algorithms that then shape the way in which people interact, do you think that your work and also Nesta's work can be helpful in solving bigger problems such as climate change or behaviours that we might have?
The Longitude Prize, for instance, was a £10 million prize that the British public voted on, choosing from other existential threats, including food security and water security. And the public chose antimicrobial resistance. And we've used the Challenge Prize as a way of both mobilising a lot of resources, because in terms of in prize money, people tend to invest a lot more in developed networks that are more valuable than the prize fund itself. So we're trying to use that as a small intervention, which will hopefully have a huge change. We're also using it as a way to build awareness and to develop connections between different scientific communities and industry throughout the world. So we do try and mobilize intelligence and networks as a resource to battle against existential threats to humanity.
One of Nesta's priorities is supporting future thinking ideas in technology that will improve the world, as you know, you sort of talked us through. What kinds of global issues is Nesta currently helping to tackle?
One thing that flows throughout a lot of Nesta's thinking is the necessity of thinking boldly and broadly about future solutions. So we're not just iterating on one solution, we can in fact see the whole range of possibilities. And one of the ways that we do that is by thinking speculatively. In our work with health, for instance, we've done a report called NHS 2030, which imagines a feasible but optimistic view of what a future health service would be, one that mobilizes the resources of intelligence, activity, and motivation that are part of the population as a whole, as well as trained medical professionals using novel technologies and data gathering and artificial intelligence to manage that. And that woven throughout the practical report there are stories of people using this these technologies and living with it. In terms of the antimicrobial resistance, we commissioned sci-fi writers and worked with academics who think about how we communicate ideas about threats, drawing in fact on the long history of work in that in climate change, to think about how we can responsibly communicate about existential threats. Because a lot of the time, the worry is that as soon as you tell someone the scale of the challenge, they're paralyzed and they can't move. So we try and use those kind of ideas.
Sounds like a very integrated approach. Working at Nesta, do you feel that you have a sense of responsibility for the future of the planet?
That's a big question. I certainly feel the world's responsibilities rest on my shoulders, but I don't think that's in my job description.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Lydia. That was absolutely fascinating. Next up, we'll be talking with Ben Still, an award-winning science communicator and physicist. That's after this.
Do, 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 do. Squarespace. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. Whether the story behind your passion is out of the ordinary or simply out of this world, you should tell it in an unforgettable way. Squarespace helps you do just that, with the only websites designed to showcase what makes your passion worth pursuing. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/guardian.
Welcome back. We've just spoken with Lydia Nicholas about innovative ways to interpret data, but how about the actual implementation of that data? Well, joining us now is Ben Still, a scientist, secondary school professor, and public speaker, specialising in the communication of physics, which is one of my favourite topics. Let's dive straight in. So at its best, science is the systematic study of the world through observation and experiment, and it's a practice that enables us to make our way towards answers to generally fairly complex questions. So from a scientific perspective, how complicated do you think is the answer to climate change? Let's start with a big one.
That is a big one. I have to say, working from a particle physics perspective and thinking about the quantum world and the underlying probabilities that we have to deal with and the millions upon billions of events that we have to measure just to extract some very simple correlations in the data, when you then expand that to something as large scale and macroscopic as climate change or an entire planet, how it's able to, you know, how certain scientists are able to extract some of these correlations out is really impressive. It's very difficult to model anything like that, such as the weather. This is why the Met Office has one of the largest computers in the world. From my point of view, it's a very tall feat, but certain correlations are coming out and they're quite prevalent. And you can see this in our action and how that is correlated with the warming of our planet. And that's one thing that we can show, I think, for certain. But how I'm predicting the future, how this is going to evolve, is, you know, very, very tough, very difficult, as can be seen by, you know, the fact that the Met Office will get wrong what the British weather's like on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I think the British weather is probably a bit of an enigma to everyone, including
for everyone. <Matt.
laughs> But in terms of dealing with really complex situations, I suppose on the one hand, there's a psychological aspect, which is how do you enable people to not feel so overwhelmed that they then just become paralyzed by the complexity of the thing? And then the secondary aspect is, well, how do you design systems that will give you enough clarity or enough simplicity to be able to understand what it is that's meaningful amongst all of the data?
And therein lies the rub, I think. That's the real challenge when presented with so much information. Understanding your priors and understanding the story behind the data, if you like, and how the data has got to this point is as much important than filtering it out and trying to find patterns and trying to find rhyme and reason in it. Is as much important as actually taking the data itself and then trying to analyze it, because if you're starting off with an unknown to start with, you haven't got that a prior knowledge, then moving on to try and extract something from it, you could be, I guess, trying to read German from a French text, and it's not going to happen. You might get the odd word here and there, but you're not going to get the whole story. Whereas I think coming at it with a good grounding and understanding of, say, for instance, in particle physics, the detectors and exactly what they are giving you in terms of the data is so important and something that really can't be overlooked. And so, you know, with that knowledge in hand, it makes it so much more easy then to pick out the story. So I think that really is number one.
And so do you think that to adequately address climate change, that people need to come together, so both scientists, engineers, and maybe other points, sort of data points, to be able to work together to improve existing technologies and develop new ones? Like, what's the role of the people involved in coming up with solutions that will actually be able to implement?
Yeah, I think climate change is certainly something where kind of citizen science would really take hold, and something where we have lots and lots of data coming from lots of different types of technologies being fed into one central repository. Because it's not just in understanding the technologies that are giving us the data, but also in variation of technologies, because if you have just a single technology measuring the world around us, then there could be some underlying unknown in the technology. And to weed those kind of things out, again, having lots of different technologies measuring it. But I think with something as big and complex as climate change, something like citizen science, where we have the public contributing data from their smartphones or something like this, will really add to the data set and add to our understanding. With the complexity that we have, we need more data points to understand.
And so do you think something like an open source approach is kind of the model that we're perhaps moving towards?
I'd like to hope so. Yeah, I mean, certainly, I mean, if you just look at the publishing world in academia, it's moving towards more open source publishing, and I think it's the right way. I mean, the archive in the particle physics and astronomy community has been running for years now as a preprint archive where people will usually upload the first drafts or second drafts of their papers before it then gets published in journals. And this has been a great way to quickly understand what is quite a rapidly changing face of the science. And so I think, you know, open source is a great way to go in terms of developing, you know, the data, but also hopefully developing the tools that we are using to analyze that data as well. I mean, open source software has caused a great, fantastic explosion amongst lots of different areas of software. And data science now, I think, is reaping the benefits of all that open source effort by all those people.
So as a physicist, what have you seen taking place to combat climate change? You've mentioned a little bit about open source and data science approaches helping us to make more rapid change. Is there anything else that you've seen that's really exciting to you, that you think is really kind of promising?
In terms of linking climate change directly to particle physics, there's obviously a lot of technological spin-offs that come from our work as particle physicists, and especially from CERN, which I have to say, the experiment I worked on was in Japan, and although I've worked with CERN colleagues, I don't do things directly with them, but the technological spin-offs that have come from CERN and from other particle physics labs are doing a lot, actually, to help us improve the efficiency of our electronics, reduce costs for production of our everyday items day-to-day. And so, in a way, that is where, I guess, particle physics is helping very much, is in the technological side of things and making what have become essential parts of our modern lives much more efficient and cheaper to produce. And if they're cheaper to produce, they have less stages, which also contributes less towards the manufacturing kind of emissions that will go towards global warming.
So when you're talking about these issues with your secondary school pupils, what kind of ways are you able to communicate to them what's actually happening? And are they getting incentivized to make their own changes in their own behaviors to help the cause?
Definitely. I mean, a core part of the GCSE right now is a big section on electricity generation. And it's kind of focused almost solely around the debate between different types of electricity generation and the pros and cons of each. And they really enjoy that. They really get heated because there's a lot about the future that they need to start thinking about. And they understand this. I think they're quite astute. Students of today, and so they really get their teeth stuck into the big issues, and very few of them haven't seen a wind turbine, don't know what a solar cell is, and so they bring a lot of kind of their own pre-knowledge to the table, and it's always great to see them walk away with a more balanced idea.
So in terms of the weekend and the Future Everything conference, what are you going to be speaking about?
So this weekend I'm taking part in a discussion with a great digital artist called Moritz Stefana, and we're going to be talking about generally how we can find information in the noise. And so he's been doing a great project, Project UCO, where he's looking at weather data, and I'm going to be talking about how that parallels with finding information from the quantum world and from particle detectors. And then I'm going to be giving a talk also on how generally the quantum world is such an interesting and bizarre place, and how uncertainty comes into play with not only Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and the fact that there is a granulation, a pixelation to nature itself, but also the fact that we have to build up a picture pixel by pixel, much like, I guess, the pointillist painting, before we can actually then discover more about nature itself.
Ben, I think we should do an entire podcast just on that. But sadly, that's all we've got time for today. So thank you very much to our guests, Drew Hammond, Lydia Nicholas and Ben Still, for being on the show this week. They'll all be speaking at the Future Everything Festival this weekend in Manchester. Now, Drew, can you give us a quick plug for the event?
Every year at Future Everything, we take on issues that really matter to us, that we're really passionate about, and we look at them through the lens of art, design, digital culture. So the festival will involve some fantastic speakers. You're hearing from some of them today, some incredible artists, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
So for more information, visit futureeverything.org. I'm Natalie Nahai. You can find me on Twitter at Natalie Nahai. This episode of Tech Weekly was produced by Matt Shaw. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again next week.
The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs.
To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com. Also, subscribe to the Guardian Live podcast. You can do so on iTunes, SoundCloud, and other reputable audio platforms.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.